Excellent. Not up yet. Good. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you very much for the invitation to address this conference. I just realised, looking up, how many people there are in the room. It's very impressive. Thank you. One thing that I forgot to mention in my profile, which you remarked on was rather short, is that I'm also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, which I'm assuming some people have heard of. I inflicted my views on that on about 25 people yesterday in a workshop, and a lot of what I do is connected to my work as the editor-in-chief of that journal, and certainly a lot of work that I do in the Far East, Southeast Asia, and increasingly in the Middle East, and in recent years I've been visiting Saudi Arabia very regularly. I'm also a visitor at the King Saud University. I've been working in Qatar, Oman, Bahrain, and so I've got to know the region reasonably well, and I really greatly enjoy my time here. Well, I want to also, I don't know if it's appropriate to thank AFA for basically giving my talk for me. So this will be about 5 minutes long. She's covered many of the things that I was going to cover. But actually that's good, because I can re-emphasise them. Not quite as well as AFAF. I let you into a secret. I'm not an expert at all on global health, but I had the privilege of being part of the Global Advisory Panel on the Future of Nursing, which is a Sigma Theta Tau initiative initiated a couple of years ago. I'm no longer a member of that, but I'm going to refer to that at least once during the talk here. So that was my introduction to global health, really. And I see increasingly in the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and of course it wouldn't be me if I didn't refer to it a couple of times in my talk, I see increasingly global health issues being mentioned. So I'm becoming increasingly interested in the area, especially not as a researcher, but as the editor of what I consider to be one of the leading academic nursing journals in the world, Commercial Advert over. Now, I come from the University of Hull. If I asked how many people had been to the UK, I'm sure a lot of hands would shoot up. If I asked how many people had been to Hull, I guess none. So I better tell you where it is before I do anything else. That's the world, as I'm sure you know, and that's how I got here. And that's Europe, and that's the UK. For those of you who haven't been there, very small place, but I hope you'll agree, very influential. And Hull is there, Kingston-upon-Hull, on the east coast of the UK. Hull's a very small town. It's a university town. We were the 14th university in the UK. There are now over 100 universities in the UK, but we proudly claim that at one time we were the 14th ranked institution, but we forget to remind people there were only 14 at the time. Sites of Hull, the Humber Bridge. This used to be the longest suspension bridge in the world. Not the longest bridge, but the longest suspension bridge, until the Hong Kong authorities built the similar bridge between Hong Kong and Lantau Island. So this is no longer the longest bridge in the world. It's 2 miles long. I regularly run across it with my wife. It's very good for running. It looks like it's flat, but it's not. It's got a big bow in the middle. We've got an excellent football team that's not doing very well at the moment, called the Tigers. It's a long time since they've celebrated scoring a goal, but I just thought my loyalty to my now home team I'd display. But they're in the second division, but we're working hard at supporting them to get back up into the second division. Anybody who understands regional accents in the UK will realise that I'm Scottish. I come from the top of the UK, but I've been living in Hull for quite a long time. What else can I tell you? That's a picture of the administrative building at the University of Hull, and I hope that someday some of you will come and see us there and visit us there. We do have some Saudi students there. We've got one Saudi student in our nursing department and our faculty, and I'm just in the process of recruiting more Saudi students to come. Right, so that's enough of an introduction. What else can I tell you? Well, I'm going to outline some of the key global health issues facing when nursing education. Of course, this is viewed largely from a UK perspective, but I thought one or two of the issues that I'd like to pick up on were... I'm jumping the gun here. Before I go on to that, global health definitions, I'm not expecting... You saw it quickly flicked up there. I'm not expecting anybody to write that down or remember it. Global health definitions vary. There are as many variations on it as the people you ask. And the Global Advisory Panel on the Future of Nursing, GAPFON, and you can Google that and find the GAPFON very easily. This is their definition of global health, but it implies everything that AFAF was talking about, from caring for people right through ecosystems and down to holistic care. But what GAPFON have been most concerned about is trying to... I can see people screwing their eyes to read that. Please don't, because we'll be here all day. What GAPFON have been concerned to do is to try and derive a definition for global nursing, which doesn't really exist. And I just want to, again, just flash it up there. Don't try and read it all or memorise it. The Journal of Advanced Nursing is just about to publish a special editorial written by colleagues from GAPFON, led by Linda Law-Wilson, but including other people like Hester Klopper and others who initiated GAPFON, in which we publish these definitions and the background to it, all the literature leading up to it. So that's another advert for the Journal of Advanced Nursing there. Okay, the global issues facing nursing are many. This is not an exhaustive list by any means, but I think these are the ones that probably have the most relevance to education, not just in the UK. The ageing of the nursing workforce. We're getting older. We are beginning to look more and more like me, with grey hair and older, and I'll give you some figures on that. That has profound implications, not only for the workforce, but of course anything that has implications for the workforce has implications for nursing education. And also the ageing of the population, and AFAF mentioned that, and I'll come back to that. That's my particular area of interest. We also grapple, I'm afraid to say, many great things are happening in nursing, and I like AFAF's positive view of this, trying to promote the positive things that are happening. But we do still suffer from a poor image of nursing, and despite some of the good things that are happening very recently, for example in the UK, the image of nursing there is very poor, and that can be demonstrated by picking up any broadsheet newspaper. Whenever there's an argument about nursing, people don't get to the truth. They immediately project the wrong image of nursing: largely female, largely stupid, largely only concerned with doing physical care and not engaging intellectually with anything. I think we've got a real problem in nursing demonstrating what we do and demonstrating cost effectiveness. Is nursing worth the money we spend on it? And I think, I think this is relevant to nursing education, because again, I agree with AFAF. I think we maybe need to shift some of the fundamentals of care out of the curriculum and get in more sort of ideological aspects that will help nursing students to enter the profession, proud of the profession, and able to defend it. And other miscellaneous things, again, AFAF got there before me. Genomics, that's a big issue. And again, we've just published, we have published a special issue in Jan on genomics, if you want to look that up. Get there quickly, because you can get the papers to download for free. And we've just published one that's not dissimilar from that on sickle cell anemia, which of course is related to genomics and genetic counselling and such like. Preparation for disasters. AFAF and I didn't meet before this to talk climate change, okay? All these things have been mentioned, but I just want to, briefly mention how they could be relevant or perhaps brought into to nursing education. And again, I'll say here for a start, I know that bringing more and more into nursing education requires shifting some things out, especially in the UK. We only have a three-year programme there, and we just can't get everything into it. And I do think there are things that we can shift out. And from talking to colleagues at the university here, we've already identified things that perhaps could be... I don't want to cause any problems or trouble, but there are things that could be shifted out of all curricula to educate us better. But this list isn't by any means exhaustive. I don't know how many of you subscribe to the excellent newsletter. It comes out 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, called Global Health Now, and it's put out by the Johns Hopkins, I think it's from the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, if I'm not mistaken. And it's really excellent. It comes out every day. It gives you a summary of all the major global health issues. And, you know, it just shows you how wide-ranging global health can be. Everything from gun control in the USA down to climate change, but all the things in between that you'd expect. And some of the major issues which are hitting the headlines in global health now are vaccination. Not just vaccination programs and how to implement them, that's the job of the World Health Organization, but the propaganda against vaccination in many countries, especially in some of the sub-Saharan African countries. Even in the UK, there are movements against vaccination, people who believe that it's wrong or causing harm that it's not causing. This is raising its head, and we need to be able to counter that with good facts. Female genital mutilation, that's a regular feature in global health now, and something that we've picked up in JAN as well, and something that really needs to be addressed. I think it's one of the... I'm a father of four daughters, I just think it's one of the most repulsive practices worldwide. It hasn't got to be tolerated or worked into nursing education or practice. It just has to be completely and utterly eradicated. Things like global pandemics, SARS in China from about 10 years ago, MERS recently here in Saudi Arabia. And I think the thing that we need to educate nurses to do is to understand these global pandemics, because one thing is they never actually turn into global pandemics. They're usually pretty localised, very few people suffer from them. I'm not saying that's not important, that people don't suffer, but we need to educate nurses to help people not to panic. And other issues like violence against women, rape and so on, all these things come up. But these are all important issues. We can't deal with them all today, and we probably can't pack them all into the nursing curriculum, but we do need to at least raise the awareness of nursing students about these. Excuse me. So, ageing of the nursing workforce. As I say, certainly, many nurses are beginning to look like me. That's not me, but it doesn't look unlike me. I'm not pointing to the ageing of the nursing workforce as necessarily being a bad thing. There are lots of problems but there are lots of problems as a consequence. I don't know how well you can read that, but the average age of employed nurses is in most countries well up into the 40s or getting there, and it's moving up gradually. I don't have a graph demonstrating that. I couldn't find one, but I have seen graphs demonstrating that over the years in the UK. And, you know, in other words, in countries where there's a compulsory retirement age or a sort of average age of retirement, it means that people are approaching that age. And don't assume that somebody, for example, in New Zealand, who's 44 and where they've got an average retirement age of 60, is going to make it all the way through to 60. What happens to older nurses is they tend to retire early because of all sorts of reasons associated with the job. It has a different... This is from the UK. In fact, it's from Scotland, from my own country. I don't know how this transfers internationally, but it does have a differential effect on different aspects of nursing. It's something that's not so acute in acute care, but we tend to have older nurses in mental health and older nurses working out in the community in primary care, simply because often you've got to undergo secondary, tertiary levels of continuing training to get there, so they tend to be older. So the effect of the ageing nursing workforce is differential. So the challenges of an ageing nursing workforce are recruitment and replacement, because older nurses will retire and go, and we are not, certainly in the UK, replacing these at an adequate rate at the bottom. We need to learn how to retain older nurses. I did a study for a charity in the UK about 15 years ago called the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, called Nurses Over 50, Options and Outcomes. And it was very clear that there were significant problems retaining older nurses because of all sorts of reasons, physical, psychological strain being top of the list, lack of opportunities as well. And plain and simple age prejudice, ageism. You know, flexible work patterns, this is something that's absolutely crucial. Older nurses, certainly in my country, are a sandwich generation, many of them still caring for children and caring for older parents as well. And my wife and I are perfect examples of that. Professional development opportunities tend to decline for older nurses, and we simply don't tend to value older nurses. I'm afraid to say that our interviews with health service managers and union leaders, trade union leaders in the UK, showed that there were certainly ageist attitudes. I'll come back to some of the things that we might need to do to deal with that. But related to the ageing of the nursing workforce is the migration of nurses. And this is a big, I'm not saying it's a global problem, it's a global issue. It's a problem for some countries. In the UK, there was a time back in 2001, about just over a decade ago, when the admission of to the UK nursing register of new nurses was UK admissions were outstripped by international nurses, by foreign nurses or overseas nurses. This is declining, as you can see, but it's still at a very high level. Now, international nurses make a fantastic contribution in any country that they go to. I'm not saying we should send international nurses back to their own countries. There's certainly been some campaigns in UK newspapers to that effect. I think that's entirely and utterly wrong-headed. But there is something wrong in a country where you can't produce enough of your own nurses. And I know this is a huge issue in Saudi Arabia just now. And there's a paper, not authored by me, just about to come out in International Nursing Review, written by Dr. Ahmad, the Dean at King Saud University, on this very issue. And of course, we know the predominant trend to the UK is predominantly from the Philippines. And looking around this audience, I can see, and I know it's very much the same in Saudi. And this isn't too much of a problem, because the Philippines deliberately overproduce nurses for economic reasons. But it is a problem for other countries. So the challenges of migratory nursing workforces and regulation and registration. And this certainly in the UK has a profound implication for nursing education, because people have to be educated to work in the UK. They have to undergo a transition of about 6 months or return to practice programmes to come in. Cross-cultural issues. I have no idea about the problems in Saudi in terms of nursing disciplinary issues, but in the UK there's a disproportionate amount of money spent by a regulatory body on two groups of people. One, men in nursing. We're much less well behaved than women in nursing. We're the primary. We're disproportionately represented in disciplinary hearings, and overseas nurses and male overseas nurses at the top of that list. So there's something going wrong. There's something wrong there. So there are issues to be dealt with. And there's also, in the case of some countries, certainly in African countries, a very negative effect on the healthcare in those developing countries. They lose nurses, they lose younger nurses who go abroad. So we need to think about that as well. And also, there's something that the Global Advisory Panel, GAPFON, is trying to deal with. One of the things they want to address is the lack of standardisation of nursing registration globally, what it means to be a nurse in different countries. And of course, this is an educational issue. So the educational implications, recruitment and retention. We need to educate more young nurses. That's a volume issue. Recruitment and retention. We've got issues in the workforce as well. We bleed young nurses and newly qualified nurses out of our National Health Service in the UK. We need to address that issue as well. I think often they don't really know what they're going into. They're not properly prepared for practice, despite 50% of the time being spent there. They don't actually know exactly what it's like to be clinically responsible. But this is something that is being addressed, and I'll mention by whom later. We do need globally to increase the educational level of nurses. That's something that GAPFON is certainly advocating and addressing. Specifically, in my view, all nurses need to be educated at tertiary level and to be graduate nurses. I'm sure most people in the room are, but it's been a very recent move in the UK within the last 3 or 4 years whereby all new nurses entering the register are educated to graduate level. And we need to, that's an input, we need to increase the educational level of nurses, increase the professional status of nurses. Easier said than done, all these things. We don't have time today to look into the solutions. And we do need, despite many of the advances that have been made, we do need to improve the image of nursing. But I think that's an outcome of the input of increasing educational level and increasing professional status. The image of nursing, as I've mentioned, in my country is pretty low. So what are the things that we need to educate nurses about? Well, nurses need to be aware of the ageing population in all countries. Ageing can't be ignored. This is a very young population in this country, but it is getting older, and the more successful your healthcare system is, as it has been in many developed countries, and the more that the demographics related to childbirth change, the more nurses will be required to care for more older people. Aging is inevitable. There are things that happen. I think nurses need to be educated about that. We know what the changes in aging are. We can see them, but I think we do need to. I'm not going to give you a lesson in stem cell biology, but I mean, we do need to understand that there are actually, distinct biochemical and molecular biological changes that lead to aging. So, for example, if we, this is what's happened in some countries. This is an issue that needs to be addressed. That was the profile of the population in terms of males and females and their ages in China in 1970, about over 40 years ago. And this is a sort of healthy kind of profile in the sense that there are plenty of young people there to look after the fewer older people at the top. But of course, as healthcare has increased and of course, in China, also the one-child policy has bitten. Look how the demographics are now and projected to be. In other words, the thing is completely inverted. So there aren't enough young people and coming into nursing to look after that population. By comparison, Saudi has a pretty healthy profile at the moment, but that won't last. That'll change. Just as a matter of interest, just to compare it with the United States, where it's creeping up. People live longer in the United States, but that has inevitable consequences of requiring more healthcare. So these changes have to be taken into account, and I think that nurses need to be aware of these as students to think ahead, not just the time when they're studying or the time they immediately go into practice, but what's going to happen 20 years down the line. Where do they want to be practicing? Where are the priorities? And caring for older people is my sort of passion. I don't know how well I can convey that passion, but we Scots are not very passionate people. But aging, as we often say, doesn't come alone. I think there's a real predilection amongst nurses to work in acute areas of care, to be lulled by technology, and to go into intensive care and to life support, these kind of things. When I walked into the college the other day, there was lots about life support and acute care. I didn't see much about caring for older people. If you want to work in a complex environment, try caring for older people. Very often, very few older people don't have at least one chronic disease, and many of them have three or four. So. Also has implications for pharmacology. Again, if you want to work in an area where pharmacological knowledge is required, work with older people. The effects of drug interactions and side effects are much greater here. This is not an area for people who are not educated or don't understand much about nursing, medicine or biology. This is an area where people need to be acutely well educated and to care for this kind of population, and increasingly required. So I hope that as nursing educators, we're taking this into consideration. So what are the implications? Well, we must try to teach care of older people as if it matters, as if it's, you know, if it does matter, we must teach it in such a way that makes students want to go into it. And I just think globally we tend to be failing on that. I don't often get involved in interviewing the students coming into my school. We interview them all. That's our government policy. A huge waste of time, but never mind, I won't be political. But if I ask, you know, if you ask them why they want to come into nursing, it's a bit of a cliche, but lots of them say, well, I cared for my aging parent or my grandfather or my grandparents and watched them die and I was able to see what I could do. And I think, you know, that's good. That's a common story. What do you want to be when you qualify? I want to work in casualty or intensive care. You know, they're not taking what they learned there and wanting to do it. That's what got them in, but for some reason they think that proper nursing is working in a high-tech, high-pressured environment. So the educational implications of an ageing population are that we need to develop competence in nursing older people. In fact, we need to develop competencies for those going in. So they need to have the right knowledge, skills and attitude. These need to be integrated. And just for example, you know, nurses need to understand the process of ageing. They need to understand how disparate it is, what it comes with, how it affects care, how it affects the biological aspects of ageing, how it affects the pharmacology, and so forth. Ageing is not something that takes place for 4 or 5 years at the end of your life these days. People are living for 20, 25 years, beyond their retirement age, often having picked up a chronic condition on the way. Skills, you know, knowing what to do with regard to the ageing process, I've just mentioned that. And also the attitudes, you know, combating ageist attitudes. I continually encounter ageist attitudes amongst my nursing students and amongst nurses in practice, using infantilising language towards older people. Dear, darling, sweetie, this kind of thing. Why can't we just talk to older people normally, like adults, like we talk to each other? That's how they want to be talked to. We've got a long way to go. We work very hard in our undergraduate curriculum in doing this, but I'm afraid that we largely seem to fail. Poor image of nursing. I'm not going to talk about this for very long, and I think this particular picture probably isn't as relevant in Saudi as it is in the West. But you know, there is an image in the media of nursing being female, of being caring angels who are attractive to men, and that's really their only kind of function. You know, we get stories. Newspapers still project this, and we get novels. You know, the doctor's nurse. What it says there is, why did this handsome surgeon, old enough to be her father, want of her? Did he expect her to be more than a devoted nurse? Apologies for that, but it's just, you know, we do need to do this. But it's easier said than done. And challenging the image of the poor image of nursing begins in nursing education, and it is the responsibility of people like myself and my colleagues here to educate nursing students appropriately about their job. I would like to eradicate the phrase, which I often hear at dinner parties and conferences when someone's introduced and they say, what do you do? And they say, I'm only a nurse. I want to stop that completely. If I achieve nothing else before I die, and people stop introducing themselves as only a nurse, meaning that they're either not a doctor or not something else. We do tend to undervalue ourselves. I hear it all the time. I have two daughters who've gone into nursing. I've threatened them within an inch of their lives if I ever hear them saying that. This is changing, but we do tend to lack places at the high table on policy issues. This is getting better, and it's something that GapFon really wants to work for. But the reason we do this is that we're not training nurses at the undergraduate level to be leaders. And I'm stealing AFAF's ideas here because she addressed this issue, and I will come back to that. And we also have a very, very low investment generally. This is something that's reported worldwide, a low investment in professional development. 3 years in a nursing school, or 4 years or whatever, and coming out into practice doesn't make you the complete package as a nurse. There needs to be further development, it needs to be deliberate, and it needs to be funded. And in the UK, the differential funding between medical postgraduate education and nursing postgraduate education is vast, and the nurses outnumber doctors in the UK, I don't know, 6 to 1, 7 to 1, something like that. So we need to address that, and I know it's an issue worldwide. educational implications of this. Well, I do think that, you know, I don't want to take up all of the curriculum with history, but not many undergraduate nursing programs deliberately teach the history of nursing. I don't mean just going back to Florence Nightingale or Mary Seacole or Ruth Fida in the Middle East or whatever. The developments, the things that nursing has actually contributed along the way. So I think we do need to address the historical issues. It's not all about acute care and learning how to deal with respiratory machines and all the rest of it. I think we do need to look back a little bit. And I do think, again, that we need to make leadership integral to nursing education. It needs to be in there. And I don't mean that I'm ambiguous about whether we can teach people to be leaders or not. I think people are probably born to some extent that way. We can nurture them. But I think we need to get across to nursing students that they will be expected to be leaders, not just managers, not just administrators, but leaders. We confuse those things very easily. And to do that, those of us who are nursing educators need to exemplify leadership and the research contribution of nursing down the years. One fantastic example sitting right in front of me here is Afaf Malisa's leadership of a Lancet commission, which wasn't about nursing directly, it was about global issues. You know, that's a fantastic example. If somebody wants to know what a nurse is doing other than nursing, you know, that's a great example. But also examples within our discipline or our subject. Improvement and widened access to professional development. I've said that already. But I have to say, one of the things that has to be grasped here, and it's a nettle, this is an idiom, a nettle that has to be grasped in this part of the world, is the use of distance and e-learning. I have a PhD student coming from Saudi to Hull to study the attitudes towards e-learning in this part of the world. And I said to her last night, that's good. When you come to my university, you can do my course on research methods, quantitative research methods, which is delivered completely online. She said, well, I can't do that because that won't be recognised back in Saudi. So, you know, there's a real mismatch here. We can't deliver professional development in the way it's needed if we're going to do it all face-to-face. There has to be some acceptance of e-learning. I'm probably preaching to the converted here, but I know at policy level that's not accepted here. So we also need, in terms of professional development, to think about what happens to nurses after they go into practice. And we need to link, and this is a very UK issue, we need to link learning levels, educational levels, to clinical practice. That's not really been done very well. And there is another Lancet Commission on nursing at the moment, being chaired by Anne-Marie Rafferty, who some of you may know, and that's looking at UK nursing specifically. And we've just had the second Willis Commission by Lord Philip Willis, which has also looked into this. So there are some good things happening in the UK. Often the gap between commissions and implementation, however, is quite big. I mentioned demonstrating cost effectiveness. Well, what did I mean by that? Well, I think we need to educate nursing students properly to understand what the value of their profession is, and also to bust some of the myths around cost effectiveness and the contribution of nursing to care. There are some reports, high quality metrics for nursing. You can find this on Google. It's available. This is from King's College in London and the University of Southampton, written by some excellent colleagues. And this looks at what is used around the world to measure the influence of nursing care. And I'm sure if I asked you, or gave you a poll here on various aspects and asked you, you know, what do you think is one of the key indicators of nursing care, I'm sure you'd say, along with the American Nurses Association, that pressure ulcer prevalence or pressure ulcer prevention or whatever is something that is an indicator of nursing care. But is it really? This is used all the time. It's top of every list in the UK, America, wherever. I couldn't find a list from the UK to put up, but that appeared in that report. Well, actually, again, from King's College and from the University of Southampton, another report by the National nursing research unit into actually looking at metrics and actually evaluating them properly, came to the conclusion that if you compare mortality with pressure ulcer care, the evidence of sensitivity to nursing, and this is a scientific basis, not just opinion, is that the effect of nursing care on pressure ulcers development and prevalence is actually very weak. And that's easily demonstrated by the fact that the prevalence, certainly in the UK, hasn't gone down over the last 20 to 30 years. The thing that nurses are very good at, of course, certainly in acute care, is saving lives. And there's some really good evidence to support that, which I'll show you in a minute. But the challenges of demonstrating this are that we must work harder to demonstrate cost-benefit of nursing. We must demonstrate also the cost-benefit of nursing beyond acute care. This is more of a research challenge maybe than an educational challenge, but we haven't really demonstrated it in primary care and beyond to any great extent. And we must also, I think, develop a registered nurse-sensitive outcomes. We must be proud of our profession. It's not just nursing, it's registered nursing. And there is evidence, again, related to this. Implications are, I've said this before, nurses must be educated at university level. I think that's absolutely crucial, preferably at entry to the register, but if not, somewhere around there. Curricula need to include research and evidence evaluation. That goes without saying. I'm sure many curricula do. Nurses should be aware of their own evidence base. This is the thing that I really would like to see. If I stopped one of our third-year undergraduates at the University of Hull and asked them for a definition of evidence-based practice or evidence-based nursing, they could rattle it off. They could say the judicious use of the best available evidence to implement into care. If I asked them for an example, they'd be pretty hard pushed to give me one. We tend to teach them about these high-level things without giving them examples. So things like informatics should be emphasised, and we should also, I think, consider health economics modules for undergraduate nurses. Again, shifting things out if necessary. So nurses should be used to using information technology to find what they want. And here's a couple of examples. This is a little bit random. This comes from work that AFAF will know about. It comes from the Linda Aiken at University of Pennsylvania. This is work from the RN Forecast study in the UK. This is investigating something like 500,000 patient outcomes across 14 countries in Europe and looking at the effect of nurse staffing per patient. Graphic, if not blatant demonstration, is that the fewer nurses a patient has to look after, the more likely the patients are to survive. I mean, it goes without saying, those are the figures to demonstrate it. Nursing students should know this. I don't think they do. They should also know that, another thing which is a remarkable finding is that the percentage of bachelor-trained nurses, in other words, graduate nurses, as opposed to non-graduate nurses, as that goes up, that has a life-saving effect as well, it lowers failure to rescue people. And I've just submitted a paper along with colleagues in Qatar to the Journal of Advanced Nursing, which is going to demonstrate this even better than the work by Aiken et al., so look out for that. So I've got a couple of minutes left. I won't go into genomics in any great detail. AFAF mentioned genomics. It's strange how we pick up on the same issues. Challenges related here. Genetic counselling skills. I think this is a big issue in the Middle East with thalassemias and such like. I don't think undergraduate nurses are being taught anything about this. They need to understand risk. I think this is another thing that nurses need to understand is risk. What are the risks? How do you convey risk to people? We don't really do that very well either. And understanding new aspects like genetic therapies, some of them quite controversial, and I think also something that's going to come in and it's going to definitely fall on nurses is pre-diagnostic care. Increasingly people are being diagnosed, as it were, with having an Alzheimer's gene. There isn't one, but an Alzheimer's predisposition gene. How do we handle that? Okay, the obvious things, biological sciences, stats, epidemiology and risk education. I shan't dwell on educational implications of disaster nursing. AFAB did that very well. But I will dwell just for a couple of seconds before I finish on challenges related to climate care. This is something that really only has come to my attention and I think to the attention of the nursing academic journals in the recent years. Nurses need to be prepared, as Afaf said, to care for vulnerable groups, not just in disasters, but as global warming takes place, this is having a differential effect, especially on older people. This is being picked up in mainland China, and I haven't published a paper from mainland China, but I helped a colleague there to edit a paper which demonstrated this quite clearly. They had figures which were quite sensitive from China. Hasn't been published yet, as far as I know, but as soon as I find it, I'll certainly try to publicise it. But, you know, this is something we need to be aware of. It's not something we can ignore. It's not something for the climatologists, the glaciologists and the geographers. And we need to learn to work sustainably. And I'm proud to say that the Journal of Advanced Nursing has recently published papers on both of these issues. Okay, we need to have sensible education about climate change for nurses, not highly ideological, political education. We need to understand it. And I think we also, final point I'm going to make, need to promote international exchange for students. That may seem like a random point to make. Why would we want international exchange for students? How would that help them to appreciate climate change? Well, I landed at Riyadh Airport a couple of nights ago and had the effects of desertification graphically demonstrated as the dust was choking me as it blown off the desert. I wouldn't understand what that meant and the consequences of it if I didn't come here. I wouldn't understand what pollution really was if I hadn't visited Beijing, Shanghai, Xi'an, Hangzhou and Luzhou, a city where I go regularly in China. Pollution there is just unbelievable, you know. And I think people need to go, even just get off the plane, have a look, get back on again and just see these things. And I think the sooner that nursing students appreciate these things, the better, or they will just proceed in ignorance. So, once again, thank you very much for the invitation. It's always good to say in conclusion, because that wakens people up and they say, thank God he's finished. What can we do now? So, in conclusion, higher education for nurses, absolutely essential. Better provision of professional development, promoting international exchange, and recognition and nurturing of potential nursing leaders. And I think that global nursing issues have to be integrated into the nursing curricula. Thank you very much indeed.